Welcome to the Sum of It All Take Two podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're revisiting an entire past season in each episode, sharing what we think now, along with new resources, connections, and opportunities. Transcripts to our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're revisiting season two, Humanizing Disability in Mathematics, when we read and chatted about Humanizing Disabilities in Mathematics Education by Paulo Tan, Alexis Padilla, Erica Mason, and James Sheldon.
Well, Audrey, I'd like to start with a shout out to you because when you first pitched me this idea of Take Two, I was a little skeptical. I was thinking like, what would that be like to go back and revisit our episodes? But I'm really enjoying it. So shout out to you, Audrey. I think it was a great idea. And it's just so cool to go back and listen to some of our episodes from season two. And also I've been reading through our conversations because of course we have transcripts that we post. And sometimes that's a cool way to go back and just kind of revisit some thinking. Definitely enjoying it, Audrey.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for that, Mark. So let's start out with some ideas to revisit. So I went back and I was looking at this season, like you described, both in our transcripts and our episodes. And one of the things that sticks out to me most still about this book is a quote very early on. I think it's even on page like six. It's super early in the book. And they say, mathematics needs disabled students rather than disabled students need mathematics. And it was one of those quotes that I think we brought up in episode after episode, because it just really stayed with both of us. And you know, there's two pieces for me that are still kind of resonating and just in my mind. First, it's this idea that I have to keep going back to the idea that math is not static. Like it's meant to be explored and understood and played with, and that new insights and beauty is supposed to emerge. And that's been a huge learning space for me because I thought for a very long time that all math, especially the math that we teach in school, was fixed and finite and already well-defined. Mm-hmm. Like it was about getting that information into someone else's brain. And now mm-hmm. I think about all of our interactions with mathematical ideas are the exact opposite. They're developing and they're changing and they're supposed to do that. So that means that secondly, that each and every student's interaction with mathematical ideas is an opportunity for us to see new beauty and insight. So when anyone's excluded, especially our students with disabilities, it's that we all lose out. We lose out on their unique ideas and perspectives and insights. We miss out on all of these things because we don't invite them or allow space for them to share their insights. And as a result, it's a loss for all of us.
Just such great points, Audrey. And when I was reviewing this season, I went right back to that quote as well. You brought it out in one of our episodes, and it is just really, really stuck with me. Really just a highlight for me. I've actually used the quote with other people that I've worked with and out in districts here in San Diego County. And just that message that we can send to students that we are not complete without your unique brilliance is such a departure from we need to come in and rescue you and fix you. Those messages are so opposite from one another. Specifically, recently, I was in a conversation with some educators, and we were actually looking at how we might improve attendance in a particular school district. And I shared the quote that you mentioned, Audrey. And as I got into discussion with these educators, they thought of a way to come up with a particular phrase to encourage their students to come to school. And the phrase they came up with is pretty similar, which is, we are not complete without you. So this idea of our most vulnerable students actually being part of the puzzle that makes us better. And that message became a way of thinking about improving attendance as we can, you know, we communicate to kids that their presence makes us more complete. So Audrey, I'm so glad that you brought up that quote in that episode, because that conversation that I had with my fellow educators would never have happened if we wouldn't have really spent time talking about that quote.
Wow, Mark, that's such a great story. And great impact too. And so I'm curious, makes me curious how that quote might've lived for other people in other spaces and how that might've unlocked some new insights or opportunities for students on their campuses. What other ideas are you revisiting from season two?
Yeah, you know what? As I went back to review the season, Audrey, the other point that really came out pretty quickly to me is around students that have severe or profound disabilities, and how Paulo Tan and his co-authors really were advocating that when we're talking about we're not complete, we're talking about all. Sometimes we say to ourselves, we need to get our fellow educators to lift up our mild and moderate students in terms of their disabilities and how we can rehumanize mathematics for them. But what I really thought was challenging and important was the fact that they were actually talking about all of our students, including students that might have more profound disabilities. And I'm just gonna be real honest, Audrey, this is still challenging me. And I feel like I read that and I thought it was so like, wow, this is so powerful. But I think that it's still sort of faded back to the background. And I think sometimes when something seems like such a revolutionary change, sometimes we the themes creep in and I have to admit that I lost track of that. But if we look at our schools and the segregation that happens with students with profound disabilities, I think that it's just something we need to return to and I need to return to. So I wanted to make that point.
Mark, I am so glad you brought that up. I think I've lost sight of it too. And I think it's so easy when we talk about designing for our margins that we only go so far, right? And so we say, oh, right, you're slightly marginalized. So that's easier to deal with than folks who really, their whole experience is completely marginalized. And so how do we rethink that? And so thank you for bringing that up.
Oh yeah, of course. You know, there is one other thing I'd like to bring up, Audrey, because of where we're filming or recording this episode in a time that learning loss is this phrase that is out there like on a daily basis. And, you know, it sent me back to thinking about our discussions around students with disabilities. And it's made me really remind myself around, there was a phrase we used in the season called emotional toll. And I'm just thinking about the emotional toll that students endure by like bombarding a system that demands mimicking and like sort of like this whole of learning loss. So now we're going to remediate you as a student and we're gonna put you through lots and lots of mimicking again to quote unquote catch you up. And you know, I'm just thinking about our most vulnerable students, including students with disabilities, being identified for these intervention environments, and just the cycle of that emotional toll of them being labeled as deficit in a deficit around their thinking. And I just going back to something we talked about in that season, Audrey, which is like, how do we support students in becoming more proficient in thinking and reasoning? And I don't believe that that's through doing more mimicking.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you, Mark. I don't think through mimicking you can teach thinking and reasoning. I don't think that's possible. And maybe that's something that's worth as challenging, you know, folks to think about. And, you know, maybe there's a counterexample there. But there's a lot of times where we can mimic something and do a skill, like learn a skill, but can we learn how to think and reason? That's a great point. You know, after the season, you know, there's lots of things that kind of are sticky enough that stay with us, right? So there's some quotes and some ideas that we've revisited. But there's another space that is super interesting to me, which is when they describe about what mathematics could be or can be. And there's a quote that comes out of page 19, and it talks about the best mathematics is like literature. It brings a story to life before your eyes, and it involves you intellectually and emotionally. Which I love, and it sticks with me about both in the last, you know, year and a half since we recorded those episodes, like how much math have we seen that looks like literature that involves our students intellectually and emotionally? And, you know, I don't want to assess blame there, but like, what does it look like that, or why not perhaps? And I'm leaning on that. I haven't seen much of that in schools, with my own children at home even. And you know, they talk about in the book that most of the math that we teach and practice is more formal than that. It's very limiting. And But he's hopeful, the authors are hopeful, and they describe that it is possible to implement other interpretations of mathematics in schools, interpretations that are more creative and connected to who we are as unique individuals and as a collective. And so I think there's like, there's both the space there of like, have we done it yet? Are we not there yet? But could we do it, right? Alongside that, they also share on that same page about remedial math. And, you know, I would love to have said that in the last year and a half, we've seen remedial math just wiped off of the boards in our county and in our schools, and it hasn't. So here's an interesting quote around that that's still sticking with me. It's something I revisit a lot. It says, students who are assigned to these remedial types of mathematics lose out and then are blamed for their failures. Rather, the failure is ours. And how we have customarily thought about formal and remedial mathematics, both of which have consistently dehumanized disabled students.
Wow, Audrey, that quote is powerful and worth like just writing down and keeping close to you and when you forget about it, right? What's really sticking with me with that quote that you just said is the word blame. That the students are blamed for their failures. Boy, we really need to re-examine a system in which we're creating that dynamic of blame for students. You know, at the end of episode one, I remember you brought up these three assumptions that are in the book, and I think maybe this is a good place to remind ourselves of them. The first one is students with disabilities are mathematics doers and thinkers. Mm-hmm. Mathematics belongs to them. It's the second one. And we must resist the idea of disability as tragic. What's sticking with me in terms of things from this season is, you know, over this last year or two, we've been able to start getting back onto campuses in a physical way where we couldn't before. And what I'm wondering about is sort of this physical separation of students with disabilities. You know, we have this physical separation within classrooms when students are working. Sometimes they might be in the back part of a group there. There's also this physical separation on a school campus where they might be physically set apart. And, you know, we kept talking about this. We don't want to go back to normal. We want to go back to the new. So I'm revisiting that idea of physical separation now that we're back on campuses and teachers and students are back on campuses. And how do we not just go back to that physical separation that we had before? How do we just interrupt that so that we can not have this separation with our students with disabilities?
Yeah, that's a great reminder, Mark, because when we recorded, most of our schools were virtual. And so that separation wasn't as visible, right? But now that we can go back and see it, and we've read this and we've thought about this, like it kind of hits you in the face, right? Every time you see mm-hmm. students who are physically segregated, and what does that communicate about our beliefs about these students and what they're capable of doing, whether or not the mathematics belongs to them, all of those pieces. So thanks for reminding us of that. You know, Since the episodes have aired, we've also done some rethinking, right? So these are some things that are, we've already talked about some things that have just stuck with us and that we've thought more about, but there's some things that we talked about that I'm now, this is that moment where I'm glad we have a moment to kind of maybe go back and change our message or clear the air a little bit. And
right.
I'm probably going to step in all kinds of hot water. And I'm going to do so intentionally, I think this time, is that, you know, when we first talked in our first run of this season, we talked about IEP goals, and we talked about like making a small change and thinking about how, like, I think I even used the phrase, you don't have to overthrow the system, like look at the strengths, how do you highlight brilliance? And you know, the more I think about this, Mark, the more I just think that was bad advice on my part and bad thinking or maybe misguided thinking. And that, like, we talked about this just last episode, which is this idea that if you want to change the system, you have to overwhelm the system. Like our current system does not want to be changed. And I think when we take really small stabs at it and we say, oh, I'm going to change a word here that's going to promote thinking, or I'm going to, you know, make sure that it's grade level content, you know, like those are small, important steps, but they're not going to change the system. They're not going to change what's happening for our students with disabilities. And IEP sure. goals, the more I encounter them, the more I work on them, the more I talk with teachers, that's a huge leverage point. So I wow. had a teacher I was working with just recently, and we were talking about building thinking classrooms and tasks and you know, discussion. And she goes, yeah, I'd love to do that, but I have IEP goals that I have to work with my kids on. And I was like, oh, well, how might we do that with these kinds of tasks? And when she showed me the goals, they were so limiting and so written in finite, very, very careful language to dictate the exact kind of outcomes that they wanted, right? Like these kinds right. of procedural problems that I can very easily yes. measure and get done. And this teacher was just like, I can't do that. I can't do the thinking because I got to do the mimicking. Like that's what's been written into the IEP. And like, I go back to this, Mark, and I'm like, we have got to change that. Like we have got to push in these IEP meetings when goals come up, we have got to say, it's not about mimicking. It's about thinking and reasoning. It's about honoring the brilliance of these students and building on their strengths and not continuing to look at, you know, the deficits and saying, I'm going to try to fix you. And instead look at it and say, like, here are some amazing things you are capable of. How do I build off of that? How do I continue to empower you as a mathematical thinker and doer? Like, this is critical. I'm like worked up about it.
Yeah. Wow. So many things to respond to, Audrey. I really appreciate your passion around this. I mean, our IEP goals are connected to that broken medical model, right? That our students are broken. And they're broken in their procedural fluency, if you will. And we're going to create an IEP goal to fix that, to fix you. And no amount of IEP goals around mimicking are going to support our students in becoming better at thinking and reasoning, which is what they need. So I'm with you on that. I you know, before the pandemic, Audrey, this really was a passion of mine around how are we going to transform IEP goals? But I'm going to just be real honest. It's just gotten lost in the whirlwind for me over the last year or so. But I need to be more accountable for that. I mean, we need to get back to this. I need to get back to this for our students with disabilities. And I'll just finish by saying a key leverage point of transforming mathematics education for our students with disabilities is really interrupting the system around how we write IEP goals. Completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would like to, on the record, say I'm over baby steps in this area, and we have to figure out how to overwhelm the system. Otherwise, nothing's going to change.
Yeah. Yeah. A great point. And when you're saying that, I'm thinking like, we want to overwhelm the system, not the teacher. I'm thinking, right?
Yes.
So like, right. Like what if we found the things that we can efficiently support educators around that will overwhelm the system, right? And IEP goals is one of those. So if we can get to some practical steps for teachers that will actually not constrain them, but actually give them more freedom around how they do instruction, I actually think that can be the path where we can overwhelm the system.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. Good point. Not trying to overwhelm teachers. Another thing that I've been rethinking about is something that you brought up at the end of our last episode of the season, which is that where's our bias? Is our bias towards inclusion or exclusion? And this has been a super interesting thing for me to look at as folks come up with different plans for intervention and students and groups of students and students with disabilities. Like, are the plans that we're developing and putting in place and the processes and the supports, are they all bent towards inclusionary practices or exclusionary practices? So this has been a huge, like a lens almost for me to look at and examine practices that we're currently involved in and examine them and say, like, are we all together in this, or are we still segregating students off to the side?
Yeah, I love that lens as a way sort of evaluating what we're doing and why we're doing it. I actually wonder if it's also helpful in conjunction to that to go back and like just even think of some of the language we use in education, in teaching and learning, which I'm thinking about the word normal. And I know that in episode 4, you and I got into this great discussion around the word normal. And, you know, in this, since the time of all our work with Universal Design for Learning and the Myth of Average, you know, I've shared with many, many times with educators how we tend to plan and teach from the average student. But one of the things that's happened over the last couple of years, within the last year and a half, I think since we've even recorded that episode, is we've read a book by Andra Tisha Fitzgerald called Anti-Racism and UDL. And in that book, she uses this phrase, traditional systems that perpetuate institutional racism and block on-ramps to learning are designed for a mythical average learner, one who is white, privileged, at grade level, and self-regulated. And that's just such a great quote. We've shared it a few different times. But I'm also considering how students with disabilities fit into that quote. You know, that mythically average learner certainly assumes that that's a student that does not have an IEP. And so I think this is so intertwined with how we use the word normal consciously and unconsciously. And I think it's important that we consider how we move away from disability as tragedy. And I think that fits into this whole normal kind of language we use. If we embrace variability with our students, all of our students, including students with disabilities, I think we can do much better to value identity when we do that work.
I really appreciate that, Mark. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the Universal Design for Learning principles and kind of the founding pieces of that. And one of them is that the context matters to how our variability shows up, right? So like if we all have variability, there are certain contexts in which my variability is a strength, and there's other contexts where that variability is seen as something that is a barrier for me, right? So I think that at the end of that, it's about the context that matters, and we have control over the context, and that's something that we can change, right? That's something that we can think about, how we honor all of the variability of our students by manipulating what that context is in order to support them better in a way that, like you said, removes us from thinking about disability as tragedy and instead looks at it as a variability and says, like, hold on a second, like, in what ways and in what spaces and in what contexts can we see this student for the brilliant individual they are and build on their brilliance and help them grow and flourish, as opposed to the poor you, I'm so sorry, you know, there's nothing I can do to help, right?
Right, so I agree. Well, I know we're kind of getting near the end of the episode, but there's one more thing on my mind that popped up when I was reviewing the season, because it's some things that have happened recently that have really troubled me a little bit. So I'm gonna bring them out here in our short time we have left. So I was just at a conference where the speaker was referring to what they call the achievement gap. You know, we have a lot of scores coming out now and things like that. Versus what I might refer to as an opportunity gap, if I even use that phrase at all. And we've talked a lot about so much in this podcast about how language matters and how a shift in this language shifts our stance of how we view our students and whether our students are broken or our system has failed to support them, right? And I know back in episode 5 in season 2, we mentioned how Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez cautions us around gap gazing, and how that is playing out right now, like in these charts of data that we're just seeing plastered all over the news and in our districts. And when we do that, we're looking at our students with disability and saying they're not where our quote unquote normal kids are in this arbitrary measurement, and making assumptions of what they're capable of based on like those perceived deficits.
Yeah, you know, by nature, gap gazing is going to be deficit centering, right? And it makes me curious about when the last time is that we looked at data and spent the majority of our time discussing the assets of our students that the data showed. Like, what do we know about what our kids can do and what they're capable of and what they're interested in and where their brilliance is? And then think about what's next for them based on their strengths. Like you said, we're flooded right now with national and statewide data. And there is a ton of gap gazing, a ton of it. And like, if we do that, we are perpetuating that something, like that our students are broken, as opposed to that there's something in our system that's broken that needs to be changed.
Yeah, I just think that in a system where we're gonna acknowledge we live with unconscious bias, if we can come to that agreement as long as we're bombarded with messages that confirm or support our biases, we could be just deepening our bias toward our most vulnerable students. Mm. So I guess I would just say to everybody out there, we're going to be looking at data, but as we do so, I just believe we need to be very conscious of this tendency of when we do gap gaze, we may be retreading some unconscious bias, and I think we really need to guard against it.
Yeah, that confirmation bias is so hard to like work against. So it's a great note to like really think about that and have some reminders or have the time or think about the spaces that you're going to disrupt it from just confirming things that you already believe to be true. So I appreciate that. This text is probably the shortest in length. Like when you pick up the book, it is thin, it is tiny compared to the other books that we've read in our many seasons. But I feel like it is filled with such important and impactful information. So I'm glad we revisited it. I'd encourage our listeners, if you haven't had a chance to pick this one up recently, to go back and check it out again, because there's some stuff in there that we still need to work on.
Yeah, I agree, Audrey. And I will just say this last thing to our listeners. There are things you will read in this book that you won't read anywhere else. True. I just think it's very unique. So I just think it's critical. So thanks for joining us for this episode, everyone. In our next episode, we will chat about season 3, Faster Isn't Smarter. Until then, send us a tweet with the hashtag SumMathChat. That's hashtag SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going. Until then, best wishes in forging new paths.